Chapter 8. My Companions. It will be understood that those to whom I was most drawn, especially in the early days, were men of my own class, that is, men of gentle birth. But of the three Russian ex-nobles in the place, I knew and spoke to only one, Akim Akimich. The other two were the spy Af and the supposed parricide. Even with Akim, I never exchanged a word except when I felt at the end of my tether, in moments when my sadness was simply unendurable, and when I really thought I should never again have the chance of getting close to another human being. In the last chapter, I have tried to show that the convicts were of different types, and to classify them accordingly. But when I think of Akim Akimich, I cannot place him satisfactorily. He was sui generis in that establishment, so far as I was able to observe. There may have been elsewhere other men like him, to whom it seemed a matter of complete indifference whether they were free or in jail doing hard labour. In our prison, Akim was unique by his curious imperturbability of temperament. He had settled down in jail as if he was going to pass his whole life there and didn't mind it at all. All his belongings, mattress, cushions, utensils, were so arranged as to give the impression that he was living in a furnished house of his own. There was nothing provisional, temporary, transitory about him, either in speech or behaviour. He had still a good many years of his sentence to run, but I much doubt whether he ever gave a thought to the day when he would be set free. He was entirely reconciled to his condition, not as the result of conscious effort, but simply out of natural submissiveness. As far as his own comfort was concerned, it was all the same to him. He was not at all a bad fellow, and in the early days I found his advice and assistance most useful, though I must confess that his peculiarities sometimes deepened my natural melancholy until it became almost intolerable anguish. When I became desperate with silence and solitude of soul, I would make my conversation with him. I longed to hear and to reply to human speech in any form, and the more filled with gall and hatred of our surroundings that speech had been, the more closely it would have been in sympathy with my wretched mood. But he never said much. He would continue quietly sizing his lanterns, and then begin to tell me some story of how he had taken part in a review of troops in 18-such-and-such. Their divisional commander was so-and-so. The manoeuvring was neatly performed, that there had been a change in the skirmisher's system of signalling, and so on. It was all told in level, imperturbable tones, like water falling drop by drop. He put no life into his descriptions, even when he told me of a sharp skirmish at which he had been present in the Caucasus, after which his sword was decorated with the ribbon of St. Anne. The only difference was that his voice became a little more measured and grave. He lowered his tone when he pronounced the words St. Anne, as though he were revealing a great secret. Then he remained silent for at least 3 minutes, looking solemn, but not uttering a word. During the whole of that first year, there were moments when I felt only bitter hatred towards Akim Akimich. I simply cannot say why, but at such times I would despairingly curse the fate which had set his bed next to mine, so close indeed that our heads nearly touched. An hour afterwards I deeply regretted such extravagance. It was, however, only during the first year of my confinement that these violent feelings overpowered me. As time went on, I got used to Akim Akimich's singular character, and was ashamed of my former explosions. I do not remember that he and I ever became involved in anything like an open quarrel. Besides the three Russians of whom I have spoken, there were 8 other noblemen in the prison while I was there. Some of them became close friends of mine. Even the best of them, however, were morbid, aloof, and intolerant to the very last degree, and with 2 of them I was obliged to discontinue all spoken intercourse. There were only 3 who had any education, Bieski, Emtsky, and the old man, Jaisky, who had formerly been a professor of mathematics, an excellent fellow, but highly eccentric and a very narrow mental horizon in spite of his learning. Emtsky and Biesky were of a very different mould. Emtsky and I were on the best of terms from the start. We never disagreed, but although I had the greatest respect for him, I never managed to become sincerely attached to him. He was sour, embittered, mistrustful, and most reserved. That tended to repel me. The man had a closed soul, closed against all the world, and he made one feel it. Indeed, I was so conscious of the fact that I may have judged him unfairly. After all, his character bore the stamp of nobility and strength. His ineradicable scepticism made him very reserved when in company, and he guarded his own thoughts with extraordinary skill. Sceptic as he was, there was another and a reverse side to his nature, for in some respects he was a profound and unalterable believer, with unshakable faith and hope. In spite of his tact in dealing with others, he quarrelled openly with Biesky and his friend Tiesky. The first of these, Biesky, was a man of poor health, tending to consumption, irascible, and of a weak, nervous disposition. But he was, for all that, a good and generous man. His nervous irritability made him capricious as a child. That kind of temperament was too much for me under those conditions, and I soon began to see as little as possible of Biesky, though I never ceased to like him very much. It was just the other way about with Emtsky. With him I was always on easy terms, though I did not care for him at all. When I began to avoid Biesky, I had more or less to break also with Tiesky, of whom I spoke in the last chapter. I much regretted that, for, though not well educated, he had an excellent heart, a worthy and deeply spiritual man. He loved and respected Biesky, so much so that he regarded those who broke with his friend as personal enemies. He quarrelled with Emtsky on account of Biesky, and it was a long time before the breach was healed. All these people were as ill-humoured as they could be, tetchy and mistrustful, morally and physically hypersensitive. It is not to be wondered at all. Their situation was trying in the extreme, far more so than ours. They had been exiled and transported for 10 or 12 years, and what made their imprisonment yet more difficult to endure was their rooted, ingrained prejudice, especially the unfortunate but insuperable disgust with which they viewed their fellow prisoners. In their eyes, the poor fellows were no more than wild beasts, without a single quality that could be recognised as human. Everything in their previous careers and their present circumstances combined to produce this unhappy aversion. Their life in jail was a perpetual torment. They were kindly and talkative with the Circassians, the Tartars, and Isaiah Formich, but for the other prisoners they had nothing but contempt and dislike. The only one for whom they had any respect was the aged old believer. Nevertheless, I never heard a single prisoner reproach them with their birth, their religious beliefs, or their convictions, as the Russian peasant so often does to persons of different condition, especially if they happen to be foreigners. The fact is, he cannot take a foreigner seriously. To him, the foreigner seems no more than a grotesque figure of fun. The convicts manifested far more respect for the Polish nobles than for us Russians, but I don't think the Poles cared one way or the other, or took any notice of the fact. I spoke just now of Tiesky, and have something more to say of him. When he and Biesky were ordered from their first place of exile to our fortress, he carried his friend nearly the whole way. Biesky was frail and in bad health. He became exhausted before they had accomplished half the first stage of the journey. They had first been banished to Ugorsk, where they lived in tolerable comfort, and where conditions were far less severe than with us. But in consequence of a correspondence with some exiles in another town, a quite innocent exchange of letters, it was decided to remove them to our jail, where they would be under more direct government surveillance. Before their arrival, Emtsky had been quite alone, and his sufferings in that first year of his banishment must have been terrible. Jayski was the old man, always deep in prayer, to whom I referred above. Most political prisoners were comparatively young men, while Jayski was at least 50 years old. He was a worthy, gentlemanly fellow, if a little eccentric. Tiski and Biski detested him and never spoke to him. They insisted that he was obstinate and troublesome beyond endurance, and I was obliged to admit the truth of their opinion. I believe that in prison, as in every place where men are obliged to live in one another's company, whether they like it or not, quarrelling and personal hatreds are more common than under normal circumstances. Many causes contributed to those squabbles that were, alas, all too common. Jayski was really disagreeable and narrow-minded. Not one of his companions was on good terms with him. He and I never came to open rupture, but we were never really friendly. I fancy that he was a good mathematician. One day he explained to me, in his half-Russian, half-Polish jargon, an astronomical system of his own invention. I have been told that he had written a work upon the subject, which the learned world had received with derision, and I believe his reason was partially deranged. He used sometimes to spend a whole day on his knees in prayer, which earned the convict's respect during the remainder of his imprisonment. He died in my presence after a very painful illness. He had won the esteem of the prisoners from the first moment of his arrival, in consequence of an incident between the governor and himself. They had not been shaved once on the road from Ugorsk, and their hair and beards had grown very long by the time they met the governor. That worthy raged like a madman. He was wild with indignation at such a breach of discipline, though it was not their fault.
"My God! Did you ever see anything like it?" he roared. "They're vagabonds! Brigands!"
Jayski knew very little Russian, and thought that he was asking them if they were brigands or vagabonds, so he answered,
"We are political prisoners, not rogues and vagabonds." "So you mean impudence, clod!"
howled the governor.
"To the guardhouse with him! 100 strokes of the rod, this instant, I say!"
They gave the old man his punishment. He lay flat on the ground under the strokes without the slightest resistance, kept his hand between his teeth, and bore it all without a murmur, without moving a muscle. Biski and Tiski reached the jail while this was in progress. Emski was waiting for them at the principal gate, having heard of their arrival, and threw himself on their necks, although he had never seen them before. Utterly disgusted at the way the governor had received them, they told Emski all about the cruel business that had just occurred. Emski told me later that he was beside himself with rage when he heard it.
"I could not contain my wrath," he said. "I shook as though with fever. I waited for Jayski at the main gate through which he would come from the guardhouse after his punishment. The gate was opened, and there I saw Jayski pass before me, his lips all white and trembling, his face pale as death. He looked neither to right nor left, but passed through the groups of convicts assembled in the courtyard. They knew a nobleman had just been flogged, entered the barrack room, went straight to his place, and without a word, dropped down on his knees in prayer. The prisoners were surprised and touched. When I saw that old man with his white hairs, who had left behind him a wife and children, kneeling and praying after that scandalous treatment, I fled from the barrack, and for a couple of hours felt as if I were stark, staring, raving mad, or blind drunk.
From that first day, the convicts showed a marked deference to and consideration for Jayski. What particularly pleased them was that he had not uttered a cry while undergoing his punishment. But one must be fair and truthful in this matter. The distressing story is not an example of the usual treatment accorded by the authorities to transported noblemen, Russian or Polish, and this isolated case affords no basis for passing judgment upon the system as a whole. My anecdote merely shows that you may meet a bad man anywhere and everywhere. If that type of man happens to be in absolute command of a jail, and if he happens to have a grudge against a prisoner, the poor fellow's lot will be indeed very far from enviable. But the prison and commissioners who regulate and supervise convict labour in Siberia, and from whom subordinates take their tone as well as their orders, are careful to exercise discrimination when dealing with persons of noble birth, and sometimes allow them special privileges not granted to convicts of lower condition. There are obvious reasons for this. The commissioners are themselves gentlemen. They know that men of that class must not be driven to extremes. Cases have been known where noblemen have refused to submit to corporal punishment and flung themselves in desperation upon their tormentors with the gravest consequences indeed. Moreover, and this, I think, is the principal cause of leniency, some 35 years ago, a large party of Russian nobles was transported to Siberia. Their behaviour was so correct, they bore themselves with such dignity, that the authorities adopted the practice, which they never abandoned, of treating criminals of gentle birth quite differently from ordinary convicts, and subordinate officials took their cue from them. Many of these underlings, no doubt, were little pleased with the attitude of their superiors. They were only happy when they were free to behave exactly as they liked in the matter, but they had few chances to do so, for they were kept strictly within the rules. I have reason to know this, as I shall now explain. I was put in the second category, which consisted mainly of convicts who had been serfs. We were under military supervision. Now this second category, or class, was much harder than either the first, which worked in the mines, or the third, which was employed in manufacture. It was harder not only for the nobles, but for the other convicts too, because the governing and administrative system and personnel in it were military throughout, and were pretty much the same in type as those of the convict establishments in Russia itself. The officials were more severe, and the general treatment more rigorous than in the other two classes. The men were never out of irons. An escort of soldiers was always present, and you were always or nearly always within stone walls. Things were quite different in the other categories, so at least I was told by the convicts, many of whom had every reason to know. They would all gladly have gone to the mines, which the law classified as the extreme penalty. Indeed, it was their constant dream and desire to do so. All those who had been in Russian convict establishments spoke of them with horror and declared that there was no hell like them, that Siberia was a paradise compared with confinement in the fortresses of Russia. If, then, it is the case that we nobles were treated with special consideration in the prison where I served my sentence under direct control of the commander-in-chief, and where the administration was entirely on military lines, there must have been even greater leniency shown convicts of the first and third categories. I think I can speak with some authority about conditions in Siberia. For the rest, I base my views upon what I learned from convicts who had experience of all three classes. We in our prison were under much more rigorous surveillance than elsewhere. We enjoyed no sort of exemption from the ordinary rules as regards work, confinement, and the wearing of chains. We could do nothing to obtain relaxation of those. I, at any rate, was well aware that in the good old days, not so very long ago, there had been so much intrigue to undermine the reputation of officials that the authorities were terrified of informers, and that, under existing circumstances, to show indulgence to a convict was regarded as a crime. Everyone, therefore, authorities and convicts alike, lived in constant fear, and we aristocrats were reduced to the common level. The only point on which we were favoured was that of corporal punishment. Even so, I do not think we should have been spared that, had we done anything for which it was prescribed, for equality of punishment was strictly enjoined, or at least practised. What I am trying to make clear is that we were not wantonly, causelessly ill-treated, as were so many prisoners. When the commander-in-chief heard of the punishment inflicted on Jayski, he was extremely angry with the governor, and ordered him to be more careful in future. The facts became widely known. We learned also that the commander-in-chief, who had great confidence in our governor, liked him because of his exact observance of regulations and regarded him as a most efficient officer, sternly reprimanded him. The governor had taken the lesson to heart, and I have no doubt it was that which prevented his having Emski flogged, as he would have much liked to do, influenced as he was by the slanderous things Aff said about Emski. But he could never find a pretext for inflicting the punishment, however much he persecuted or set spies upon his intended victim. He had to deny himself that pleasure. The Jayski affair was noised abroad, and public opinion condemned the governor. Some persons openly reproached him for what he had done, and some even abused him to his face. I may as well describe my first encounter with the governor. Another gentleman and myself had heard, while still at Tobolsk, of the governor's atrocious character. Certain noblemen who had been condemned a long while before to 25 years of this living death kindly visited us in the transit prison and warned us of the type of man under whom we should find ourselves. They also promised to use what influence they could find with their friends in order to ensure that we suffered as little ill-treatment as possible. And in fact, they did write to the three daughters of the commander-in-chief, who, I believe, interceded on our behalf with their father. But what could he do? No more, of course, than tell the governor to be fair in applying the rules and regulations. It was about 3 in the afternoon that my companion and I reached the town. The escort took us at once before the tyrant. We awaited his arrival in an anteroom while the deputy was summoned. No sooner had that gentleman entered than in walked the governor. We saw an inflamed scarlet face that boded no good and filled us with alarm. He seemed like some kind of spider about to hurl itself at a poor fly struggling in its web. "What's your name, man?" he asked my companion, speaking in a harsh, jerky voice, as if he wanted to overawe us. My friend gave his name. "And you?" he said, turning to me and glaring at me from behind his spectacles. I gave mine. "Sergeant, take him to the prison. Have him shaved at the guardhouse, civilian-fashion hair off half their skulls, and put him in irons tomorrow." "Why, what sort of cloaks have you got there?" he said brutally, when he saw the grey cloaks with yellow patches at the back, which had been issued to us at Tobolsk. "Why, that's a new uniform, begad, a new uniform. They're always inventing something or other. That's a Petersburg trick," he said, as he inspected us one after the other. "Got anything with them?" he said abruptly to the sentry who escorted us. "They've got their own clothes, Your Excellency," replied he, and the man presented arms, just as if he were on parade, but not without a nervous tremor. Everyone knew the governor and feared him. "Take away their clothes. They can't keep anything but their white linen. Confiscate all coloured articles if they've got any. Sell them off at the next sale and put the money on the prison account. A convict has no property," said he, looking at us severely. "Listen. See you behave yourselves. Don't let me hear any complaints. If I do, cat o' nine tails. The smallest offence, and I'll have you flogged." The manner of my reception, which was so different from anything I had ever known, almost made me ill that night. It was a terrible experience on my very first day in the infernal place, but I have already told that part of my story. Thus we had no sort of exemption or immunity from any of the miseries they inflicted on us, no relaxation from the common lot, but friends tried to help Bieski and me by getting us sent for 3 months to the engineer's office to do copying work. This was done quietly and without comment. A kindness we owed to the head engineer during the short time that Lieutenant Colonel Zhikov was commander-in-chief. This gentleman held his command for only 6 months. He soon went back to Russia. He seemed to us all like an angel sent from heaven. The convicts were absolutely devoted to him. It was not mere respect, but something akin to worship. I cannot help saying so. How he managed it, I do not know, but their hearts went out to him from the moment they set eyes on him. "He's more like a father than anything else," the prisoners would often repeat during all the time he was there at the head of the engineering department. He was a brilliant, joyous fellow, short of stature and with a bold, confident expression. He was kindness itself to the convicts, for whom he appeared to entertain a sort of paternal affection. Why was he so fond of them? It is hard to say, but he seemed never to be able to pass a prisoner without stopping for a chat, a laugh, and a joke. There was nothing that smacked of authority in his pleasantries, nothing that reminded one of his official status. He behaved just as if he was one of ourselves. In spite of this kindness and condescension, I don't remember anyone failing in respect towards him or taking the slightest liberty. Quite the opposite. The convict's face would suddenly light up in an extraordinary manner when he met the chief. It was odd to see how the man's face smiled all over, and his hand went to his cap when he saw the chief approaching. A word from him was regarded as a signal honour. There are some people like that, who know how to win all hearts. Zhikov had a bold, jaunty air, walked with long strides, and held himself erect. A regular eagle, the convicts used to call him. He could not do much to lighten their lot materially, for his duty was to superintend the engineering work, the manner and quality of which was absolutely and unalterably fixed by the regulations. But if he happened to notice a gang of convicts who had finished their task, he allowed them to be back to quarters before the drum beat to mark the end of work. The prisoners loved him for the confidence he placed in them, and because of his aversion for all those mean, trifling, and exasperating interferences on the part of officious overseers. I am absolutely certain that if he had lost 1,000 rubles in notes, and the most hardened thief in the prison had found them, the fellow would not have hesitated to return them. I am quite sure of that. The prisoners all sympathized with him when they learned that he was at daggers drawn with our detested governor, which happened about a month after his arrival. Their delight knew no bounds. The governor had formerly served with him in the same regiment, so when they met after a long separation, they were at first boon companions. But the intimacy could not and did not last. They came to blows, figuratively, and Zhikov became the governor's sworn enemy. Some would have it that it was more than figuratively, that they came to actual fisticuffs. A likely enough occurrence as far as the governor was concerned, for the man had no objection to a scrimmage. When the convicts heard of the quarrel, they simply could not contain their delight. "Old Eight Eyes and the chief get on finely together. He's an eagle, but the other's a bad uni." Those who believed in the fight were mighty curious to know which of the two had had the worst of it and got a good drubbing. If it had been proved that they had never actually come to blows, I think the convicts would have been bitterly disappointed. "The chief gave him fits. You may bet your life on it," they said. "He's a little un, but bold as a Hun. The other one got into a blue funk and hid under the bed." But Zhikov left all too soon, and was keenly regretted. Our engineers were all most excellent fellows. We had 3 or 4 of them while I was there. "Our eagles never remain very long with us," said the prisoners, "especially when they're good, kind fellows." It was Zhikov who sent Biski and myself to work in his office, for he was partial to exiled nobles. When he left, our condition was still fairly endurable, for his successor showed us much sympathy and friendship. We spent some time copying reports, and our handwriting was becoming excellent, when an order came from the authorities that we were to return to hard labour as before. Some spiteful person had been at work. At bottom, however, we were rather pleased, for we had grown tired of copying. For 2 whole years I worked in company with Biski in the shops, and many a gossip we had about our hopes for the future, our ideas and our beliefs. Biski had a very odd mind, which worked in a strange, unconventional way. There are some very intelligent folk who indulge in endless paradox, but when they have endured great suffering and made great sacrifices for their ideals, it is not easy, in fact it is cruel, to try to alter their outlook. When you objected to any of Beeski's propositions, he was really hurt, and answered you with much heat. He was, perhaps, more in the right than I was as to some things wherein we differed, but we were obliged to cut short our friendship. I was sorry, for we had many things in common. As years went on, Emtsky became more and more sombre and melancholy, a prey to despair. In the early period of my imprisonment, he was communicative enough and shared his thoughts with me. When I arrived, he had just finished his second year. At first he took a lively interest in the news I brought, for he knew nothing of what had been going on in the outer world. He asked questions, listened eagerly, and showed emotion. Little by little, however, his reserve grew on him, and there was no getting at his thoughts. The glowing coals were covered up with ashes, but it was plain that his temper grew increasingly sour. "Je hais ces brigands," he would say, speaking of convicts whose acquaintance I had made. I could never make him see any good in them. He never seemed to enter fully into the meaning of anything I said in their favour, though he would sometimes appear to yield a listless assent. Next day, however, it would be just as before. "Je hais ces brigands." As we often used to converse in French, one of the overseers of the works, a soldier named Drenichnikov, used always to call us aide-chirurgien. God knows why. Emtsky never seemed to shake off his usual apathy, except when he spoke of his mother. "She is old and infirm," he said. "She loved me better than anything in the world, and I don't even know if she's alive. If she learns that I've been whipped..." Emtsky was not of noble birth, and had been whipped before he was transported. When he recalled the episode, he would gnash his teeth and could not look anybody in the face. Towards the end of his imprisonment, he used to walk to and fro, generally quite alone. One day at noon, he was summoned by the chief, who received him with a smile. "Well, Emtsky, what did you dream about last night?" he asked. Emtsky afterwards told me. When he said that, a shudder ran through me. I felt stricken at heart. He replied, "I dreamed that I had a letter from my mother." "Better than that, much better," said the chief. "You're free. Your mother has petitioned the emperor, and he has granted her prayer. Here, here's her letter and the order for your discharge. You're to leave prison immediately." He came back to us pale, scarcely able to believe his good fortune. We congratulated him. He took our hands in his, which were quite cold and trembled violently. Many of the convicts wished him joy. They were really glad to see his happiness. He settled in Siberia, establishing himself in our town, where he was shortly given some land of his own. He used often to visit the jail, bring us news, and keep us informed of all that went on, as often as he was allowed to talk with us. It was mainly political news that interested him. Besides the four Polish political prisoners, of whom I have already spoken, there were two others of that nation, who had been sentenced for very short periods. They were not well educated, but were good, simple, straightforward fellows. Then there was Achukuski, an utterly colourless type. Nor must I forget Bin, a man well on in years, who impressed us all most unfavourably. I do not know for what he had been condemned, although he used quite often to tell us some story in that connection. He was a vulgar, mean creature, with the coarse manners of a shopkeeper grown rich. He was quite without education, and seemed to take interest in nothing except what concerned his trade. He was a kind of scene painter, and showed a good deal of talent in his work. The authorities soon heard of his ability, and he was regularly employed in the town to decorate walls and ceilings. In 2 years, he adorned the rooms of every prison official. He was well paid, and was able to live fairly comfortably. He was sent to work with three other prisoners, two of whom learned the business thoroughly. One of them, in fact, a man named Chivorsky, painted nearly as well as Bin himself. The governor, who had rooms in one of the official residences, sent for Bin, and gave him a commission to decorate the walls and ceilings there, which he did so effectively that the commander-in-chief's apartments were far surpassed by those of the governor. The house itself was a ramshackle old place, while the interior, thanks to Bin, was as gay as a palace. Our worthy governor was hugely delighted, went about rubbing his hands, and told everybody that he should look out for a wife at once. "A fellow can't remain single when he lives in a place like that," he said, and meant it. Bin and his assistants advanced in the governor's good graces. They took a month to complete the work at his house. During those memorable days, the governor seemed to regard us in a new light, and began to be quite kind to us political prisoners. One day he sent for Jayski.
"Jayski," he said, "I've done you wrong. I had you beaten for nothing. I'm very sorry, do you understand? I'm very sorry. I, the governor."
Jayski answered that he understood perfectly.
"Do you understand? I, your superior, have sent for you to ask your pardon. You can hardly realize it, I suppose. What are you to me, fellow? A worm, less than a crawling worm. You're a convict, while I, by God's grace, am a governor. Governor, do you understand?"
The governor was not the only officer who spoke of himself in that lofty way. Many others did the same, especially those who had risen through the ranks. Jayski answered that he understood perfectly.
"Well, I want to be friends with you. But can you realize what I'm doing? Can you appreciate my magnanimity? Feel and appreciate it? Just think of it. I, the governor," etc., etc.
Jayski told me of this scene. There was, after all, some human feeling left in this drunken, licentious, and tormenting brute. Allowing for the man's outlook and feeble-mindedness, one cannot deny that this was generosity indeed on his part. Perhaps he was a little less drunk than usual. Perhaps more. Who can tell? The governor's glorious idea of taking a wife proved abortive. The rooms were arrayed in all their splendour, but the wife was not forthcoming. Instead of taking that blissful journey to the altar, he was summoned before the authorities, committed for trial, and was ordered to send in his resignation. It appears that some of his old sins had found him out, irregularities of which he had been guilty while superintendent of police in the neighbouring town. This crushing blow fell upon him quite suddenly and without notice. All the convicts were delighted when they heard the great news. There was rejoicing and holiday throughout the jail. The story went abroad that the governor sobbed and cried and howled like an old woman, but he was helpless in the matter. He lost his job, had to sell his 2 grey horses and everything he had in the world, and fell into complete destitution. Later on we used to meet him occasionally in threadbare civilian clothes and wearing a cap with a cockade. He would glance at us convicts with all the spite and malice at his command, but all his glory was fled with his uniform. As prison governor, he used to give himself the airs of a god in a coat and breeches. Now that was all over. He looked like the lackey he was, and a disgraced lackey at that. With fellows of that sort, a uniform is the only saving grace. Lose it, and they lose all.